Blog Talk Radio.
October 25th. We want to thank you however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. It's always great to speak with you. Well, not really with you, but we're kind of with you. But we got two fantastic authors on today. Of course, we are partnered up with PartnersInSongTour.net. We are going to start off with author Melissa Reinhardt talking about her book Stillwater, and then ending it with George Cronus and his book Dead Letter File. So again, we want to thank you all however and whenever, wherever you're listening to the show. Always great to have you. So let's kick it off right now with our first guest. Again, it is her first book, it's Stillwater, and it is a Jack McBride mystery series. So we do know that there will be a series coming up, so let's get into it. So we want to welcome Melissa to the show. So Melissa, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And thanks for having me on, John. I appreciate it.
No problem. We want to thank you for saying yes, you would be a part of the show, because I know that when you do Partners in Crime Tour, that one of the very last things it says, do you want to be involved with Suspense Radio? And you said yes, you would. So we're glad you said yes, and you're on here talking.
Yay! Yay, me too.
So let's kind of get into it. So your first book, Stillwater, it's Jack McBride Mystery Series. So we know now that we're in book one, so anybody who's listening who's like, oh, somebody's got 5 and 6 books out, I don't know if I want to go back and listen to the first. No excuse for this one, because this is book one. So why don't you just jump in and let us know exactly what is Stillwater and who is Jack McBride?
Well, Stillwater is my debut mystery novel, and it's about Jack McBride. He's an ex-FBI agent who takes a job as a small-town police chief, thinking it'll be a nice, easy gig. Hot checks, domestic disturbance, you know, traffic stops, things like that. So he wants to take an easy job, low-key, so he can reconnect with his son, Ethan, his 13-year-old son, Ethan, after his wife's disappearance a year earlier. Unfortunately, the first day, Jack gets a staged murder-suicide as his first case, and he gets beaten up by a suspect and left for dead in a ditch. And then his week gets progressively worse from there. They discover a skeleton in the woods that's been in the ground for 50 years, and so Jack starts investigating these two cases. And he discovers that there's a surprising connection that when the secret comes out, it's going to make the whole town have to rethink their idea and opinion of their small, safe, lazy East Texas town.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, this is the first book, and when you're thinking of a character and you decided that this is what you wanted to do and you're going to dive into the mystery series, so a couple questions come to mind. First of all, why Jack McBride? Why was he the best person to be your front person? And why the setting? Why the area where you put it? Is there some kind of connection to you where you put it, why you put it in a small town in Texas?
So the Jack McBride question is an interesting one. I've gotten it a couple of times, and I don't have a good answer, to be honest with you. I started this book, I don't even know how many years ago, probably 8 or 9 years ago, and it started actually as a completely different story. It was a modern-day retelling of Persuasion by Jane Austen. And, of course, the main character in that is a woman, and she is also in this. She remained in the book, even though her name's Ellie Martin. And but when I tried to write the modern day retelling, it didn't work for whatever reason, and so I put it aside. And then I picked it back up, I don't know, a couple of years later during National Novel Writing Month, which is coming up here in November, and decided to turn it into a mystery for whatever reason, I don't know. And you know, when you're starting out in a mystery, in a introducing characters and towns and things like that, it's always best to have an outsider come in, and then you can filter the town through the outsider, because they're going to notice things that people that have lived there for their entire life just really don't. So the whole stranger in a strange land thing is why I put an outsider in. Now, why is he an ex-FBI agent, Jack McBride? I don't remember why I made those choices, honestly. It just seemed like the thing to do at the time. So, but that's why I have an outsider coming in, is I just think it's best, the best way to introduce a town and a setting and people to readers. And as far as the setting, Stillwater, it's a fictional small town, but it's inspired by the small town that I grew up in East Texas. Okay. Of course, I haven't lived in a small town in 25 years, but, you know, it was critical, or it was really important in my life. And I, part of the reason I'm the person I am is where I grew up in the small town and stuff. And I just thought it would be an interesting way to approach issues. Whenever I want to insert modern societal issues and stuff through a small town setting. And also with a small town setting, I think more so than big cities, you can, you don't have to explain coincidences as much, because you automatically assume everybody knows everybody, everybody knows everything about everybody. And so, you know, someone being related to somebody or knowing some little bitty piece of information that solves the crime, I think it's a little bit easier to swallow when you have a really closed setting like that, because that's how small towns are. I mean, you know stuff about families that going back for years and years and years, decades, and it's hard to escape a lot of that stuff. So that was another reason why I thought that a small town setting for a mystery series would be a good idea.
Now, is this, I guess you want to say, in the lines of a basic kind of mystery where the reader is going to be given the clues kind of throughout, they're going to be taking to the end where everything is going to kind of be revealed? Or, you know, do you kind of run things parallel where the readers kind of know certain things, where maybe the characters don't know certain things? How did you decide to kind of set that up?
I think that the reader knows things when the characters know it. I play fair with the reader, so they should be able to figure out, I think, the clues, although I have heard from a few people that they weren't able to figure it out. They weren't able to figure out the mystery and stuff, but they all seemed to think it made sense, so I guess I did something right. But, I play fair with the reader. I don't like... I don't like it when you get to the end, you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. So I think I was able to pull it all together and have it make sense.
And growing up, were these kind of the books that you were drawn to? Were you drawn to kind of the mysteries and the whodunits, and you like to be able to kind of do the mysteries and figure those things out? Or was it something just totally different that you used to read when you were growing up?
Well, I did read my fair share of Agatha Christie growing up. Of course, I think everybody has. But I read, even now, but I read a wide variety of stuff. I don't read just mysteries or, you know, just romance or just literary. I read it all. And it just depends on what I'm in the mood and what sounds good. So I can't say that I've never, very rarely, like with Agatha Christie and stuff, have I been able to figure out when I was younger, have I been able to figure out the mystery. Now, though, it seems like, I guess it's because I'm a writer, I can figure most mysteries out pretty quick. I read a mystery that's by a very popular writer, and I've heard a lot of great things about it, and I said, I'm going to pick this up and read it. So I picked it up, I started reading it, and I was enjoying it, you know, great setting, great voice, great characters, and then as soon as the killer walked on the page, I knew it. I knew who it was, and I flipped to the back to make sure. I have a tendency to read the end of books like that a lot of times, and it was, and so I was like, yeah, I'm not going to finish this. So I think that more comes from being a writer. I do that too with television and movies and stuff. A lot of times you can just, you know what they're even going to say next, and it's kind of taking the fun out of reading and watching TV. So if there's a book that I start reading and I just get it, then I know it's a really good book.
Yeah, I kind of, I mean, I agree too. I think that there are, mysteries are a very delicate genre to write, because there are times when you have to keep things quiet and you have to keep things back, but you are teetering on that gray line of, am I cheating the reader? Am I making it to where it's, you know, when you get to the end, they're like, well, yeah, that doesn't really jive together. So it's a very different genre than like a horror or a thriller or a suspense, because, you know, you can have those parallels. But mysteries, you really can't do that. It has to be the clues and taking you up that mountain and letting you kind of see behind the curtain. So, yeah, I mean, that's a difficult thing to do. What was your biggest challenge, I guess, you want to, when you're coming out of the box and doing this?
Definitely the biggest challenge with this book was pulling the mystery together and having it make sense. You know, I knew who the killer was. I knew the motivation and everything. But I had a couple of different things playing alongside it for motivation and stuff like that. So making it all come together and make sense, I spent a lot of time staring at walls and trying to figure out, you know, okay, well, why are these people doing this? And how can I make that make sense? And, well, this is way too complicated. I need to simplify this. And so I think that was definitely the biggest challenge. Now, with the second book I wrote, The Fisher King, the sequel to this, which comes out next November 2016, the mystery part and having it all pulled together was much easier, because the killer's motivation was clear to me from the very beginning, and a very understandable, simple motivation. So that came together a lot easier, which is a good thing, because I was going to be worried that it was going to take me a long time and a lot of staring at walls to write mysteries. But I'm hoping it won't now. Maybe I'm getting better at it.
And is there one, I guess you want to say, maybe one sentence or one paragraph that you can pick out in the book that you kind of think captures some of the, you know, the essence of your style of writing and who you are as a writer, that fans will kind of be able to know and gravitate to as things go further in your career?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think I like to think of myself as a very character-driven writer. So, you know, one thing that somebody told me that they really liked about Stillwater was the actions of the characters totally made sense. You know, they said that a lot of times they'll be reading along and they're just like, why are you doing this? This doesn't make any sense at all. And they felt like that my characters, the things that they did were very understandable and very human and very recognizable, you know, whether or not you agree with it all the time at all. So that, that's what I hope I can be known for. And so in that vein, one of my favorite scenes in the book is a scene that's at a football game, a Friday night high school football game. And it's from Ellie's point of view, and she's working in the concession stand, and she's working with all of these women who are talking about Jack McBride, the new police chief. And I love that conversation, because I think it really shows the small town mentality, and it shows Ellie's character, and it shows and it also introduces a new character into the, you know, Ellie's best friend. Her name's Kelly. And I love that scene. That's the scene that really pops into my mind, that is probably my favorite in the book.
That's cool. And it's good that you're able, and it's, you know, a lot of people pick out what, you know, I kind of ask this question sporadically around, and not a lot of people would pick a scene kind of like that. It would be more of like an action scene or something a little bit different, but it's kind of different that you kind of picked, that kind of scene. That really lends to the fact of, you know, who you kind of are and how the kind of book is, you know, as a writer, to kind of have an understanding to pick that out. Yeah.
Well, one thing I will say about mysteries, I wanted to write a mystery, like I said, that was real character-driven. And so many times I'll read mysteries, and it's only about the mystery. You know, it's just, and the people love that, and that's great, that's fine, but that's not the kind of mystery I like to read. I like to read about the mystery, but I also like to read about the people that are investigating it and about the people that are, you know, like the victims and their families and the suspicion, the people who are, you know, under suspicion for being the killer and stuff like that. So that's really what I wanted to write. And so that's why I feel like Stillwater is real character driven. I feel like it's focused on the characters a little bit more than the mystery, but the mystery is the center. It's the central focus, but there's a lot of stuff that's going on around it. So, and that's kind of the stuff, that's what I like to read personally. So that's why I wrote it.
Now, I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with Melissa Linehart, and you can follow her at melissalinehart.com, LENHARDT.com, for, of course, more information on this book and everything else you have coming up. So a lot of people, of course, listen to the show, and they want to be writers, or they're just beginning out, and they're just kind of putting their toe in the water and seeing how cold the water is. Let us know kind of your journey. How did you kind of get your deal? How long, you know, what did it take? I mean, of course, everybody wants to know the magic formula, which there really is none. But I think that if they kind of understand, you know, what you kind of have to go through. So how did it work for you?
Well, I started writing fan fiction, and I was just doing it for fun, just as a way to escape. I was a stay-at-home mom and, you know, not a whole lot of, not a whole lot of deep conversations with toddlers and stuff, and it was a way to kind of keep my mind sharp and everything. So, and then I started not too long after I started, maybe a couple of years, I started writing my own stuff, and it took me a long time to really learn how to finish a book or a story. I would start something, and then I'd get a new idea, and I'd move on to something else. So I did a lot of that because I was still just having fun. It never occurred to me, really, in a million years, until about 3 or 4 years ago, to even try to get published, because I'm like, I'm not good enough to get published. I mean, I'm just doing this for fun. This is a hobby. This is just to keep my mind off of stuff. And but then just as I kept writing, I kept wanting more, and I kept, you know, developing, and I felt like I was getting, you know, better as a writer. So I decided, well, I need to start going to conferences. Let's go to a writer's conference, and, you know, they'll have information about craft, and I can, you know, I can learn something, and maybe I can become a better writer. Well, I went to the DSW Writers Conference here in the Dallas area, and with your registration, you get a pitch session with an agent. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I need to pitch something. So, which meant I need to finish something. So I finished my historical fiction novel, which is called Sawbones. I finished that, and that's what I pitched at that conference. So it was in 2013, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It didn't go very far. You know, I got rejected, and they asked for some pages, but then it was rejected. And I had pitched it to a few other agents and stuff, and got rejections. But I knew because of its setting, it was set in 1871 Texas, that people were going to look at it and immediately think Western. And it wasn't, there wasn't enough romance for it to be considered a historical romance. So I just was like, Westerns don't sell. This is going to be a tough way to get an agent. So I decided to go back to Stillwater, to that manuscript, finish it up and pitch it at the next year, the next conference, the following year. So I did, and that's where I met my agent there, and I pitched to her, and she asked for a full, and 6 weeks later, she called me and offered representation. So that is not normal. That is, you know, you usually have to...
That's not normal.
No. So whoever's listening to this, that's totally not normal. Usually you have to go through a whole lot more rejections.
But you know what that does show? That does show, again, that does show that there is no magic formula. That shows that if you go to these conferences, you keep your eyes and your ears open, you write a great book, people will find it if you just do some work. And that's really the secret formula. That's the secret sauce in all of this, is write a great book, keep your eyes and ears open, never say no to anything, and just see what happens, because there's so many people that are reading.
Right. Well, I think that is one reason why it seems to have come very easily is because I wrote for so long before I ever even considered doing to getting an agent or trying to pitch to it and stuff. So I think that by the time I did pitch, I was ready. My writing was ready. It was good enough. So, you know, for people who have just started out and have maybe finished one manuscript and they're like, okay, I'm going to pitch it to an agent and stuff. Maybe the reason they're getting rejected is just because your writing's not quite there yet. You need a little bit more time to develop and to really get your writing where to a point where an agent wants to represent it. You know, not that it's not going to, you're not going to get there, but it just might need a little more time. You might need a little more time to marinate your writing before.
Yeah.
So I think that that's, you know, that's really important. And also another thing too is that, you know, I wanted to get published, but it wasn't like, oh my God, I have to get published. It was kind of like, well, that would be cool if that happened. Well, it would be cool if I got an agent, but I wasn't obsessed with doing it. You know what I'm saying? I would have mm-hmm. kept writing and going on. And so I think that that helped when I was meeting these agents and stuff like that, because I wasn't nervous, because it was like, yeah, it's great if it happens. If it doesn't, then, you know, hey, next year. But my agent that I met at the conference, it wasn't the agent that I pitched to in the pitch session. I met her at lunch, and we sat at the same table, and we talked and visited and, you know, really kind of hit it off. And so I pitched to her outside of the formal pitch sessions. So that's mm-hmm. another thing I totally recommend when you go to conferences like this is just, you know, don't go up to agents and editors and meet them with the whole idea of, I've got to pitch to this person. Go up to them and just talk to them like they're people and get to know them and don't have really an ulterior motive. You know, that's not your primary motivation. Just get to know the people, and the pitching and the connection and stuff, I think, will come.
And, you know, because we take a lot of pitches at conferences. We know, we do Thriller Fest. We did PNWA. We have so many, and there's so many pitches that we've, you know, that we've taken and stuff like that, that we've actually been like, okay, you know, we need to take a little break right now from what
right.
we got, because we have so many books going on. But do you find that you take a lot of flack from people in the Northeast because you are a Cowboys fan?
I don't know. That's a good question. Sometimes I do feel like being from Texas and basing my stuff in Texas is could be a detriment to some people.
No, I was wondering about the tweets when you said go Cowboys. That's the thing that I would be more concerned about.
Well, I do know. So let me tell your readers about, or your listeners about this real quick. I'm doing a photo contest right now for Friday. It's called Stillwater Texas Forever is the hashtag. And if you post up a picture of football, like any kind of football, anything surrounding football or anything, for the next week or two, and you tag it with Stillwater Texas Forever, you'll be entered to win a signed Cowboys helmet signed by Jason Witten. So, you know, for people who aren't Cowboys fans, that might not be a very enticing thing. But I do think Jason Witten will be in the Hall of Fame one day. So it could be very valuable down the road. But,
did he know this?
Did
you like ask him to do this and stuff? Or?
Well, my husband's company, he was able to get the helmet for me. He works for a company that's associated with the Cowboys. So I was able to get a helmet that way. So that was nice.
Because you know which Cowboy is a massive Kindle reader, don't you?
Who?
Tony Romo.
Is he really?
Tony Romo loves to read books on the Kindle. He had been interviewed one time and mentioned that, yeah, he loves reading books, and he reads on his Kindle, and that's what he does. So, yeah, he's a huge Kindle person. So if you could try to get involved with him and do that, because I'm sure that he has a contact page on there and say, hey, I wrote this book about Dallas area, Stillwater.
Yeah.
For free, because he reads on his Kindle.
That's a great idea. Hey, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
See?
I know.
And he's going to read a lot more right now because he's hurt. So he has nothing but time.
Don't remind me.
I had him on my fantasy team, and he freaking bowls out in the second game of the season on that stupid hit because the guy landed on him. And we were like, are you serious, really? But that's okay.
You know, Tony Romo is awesome. He gets a bad shake from a lot of people and stuff. And this is showing that we really are better with. So has a tendency to get hurt. So, you know, having him be your main guy on your fantasy, I'm not sure that was a great call in the beginning.
It was good because we did draft Philip Rivers as our backup, but we did pretty good there too. So, okay. But now we got about a little less than a minute left, so I want to give you the last word to let everybody know where they can find you, your social media, and all that fun stuff.
Okay. So, like you had mentioned before, you can find me on my website. It's melissalenhart.com, L-E-N-H-A-R-D-T. I'm also on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is @SwampOfBoredom, which is inspired by Alfred Hitchcock, Rear Window. Maybe that's a quote out of Rear Window, and I'm a big fan of Hitchcock. And I'm also on Facebook, Melissa Lenhart Author. You can find me there. And I have a couple of Instagram accounts. One is Swamp of Boredom, and then the other one is Stillwater, Texas. So you can find me in either of those places.
Nice. Well,
on social media.
Well, Melissa, yeah, I want to tell you, I want to say thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to join. It's been a pleasure to have you here as a tour stop on Partners in Crime Tour. Wish you nothing but the best. Keep going on with the tour, and we will talk with you some other time.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
All right. Go Vikings. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is Melissa Lenhart, and you can find her out. The book is Stillwater, a Jack McBride mystery book, first in the series, so make sure you go check that out. We're going to take a very short break. We're going to be back here with our next guest talking about his book, Dead Letter File, and then after the show, I'm out to the car, and I'm driving to Las Vegas for a couple days because I need to decompress. So in the meantime, you guys can listen to this. Want to be back. We're going to get back right here with our next guest, George Cronus. His book is called Dead Letter File. So we want to welcome George to the show. So, George, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Hey, my pleasure for coming. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Again, another coming here, we've got Partners in Crime Tours is doing a lot of tours going on. We had a tour, and a lot of people are now taking advantage of their great service. It's great to have you on here. So give us a little bit about your book, Dead Letter File. What can fans expect to see when they get into it?
Well, it's part detective mystery. It's part spy fiction. It was an idea I had many years ago and actually started some early work on it and then put it on the shelf because I was lacking time. And after I completed my first novel, Sudetenland, and published that last year, I decided I wanted to come back to Dead Letter File. It's a neat story. It takes place in Los Angeles in the late 1940s. And there's two reasons for that. One, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I have all these fond memories of places that are just no longer there. And they've been bulldozed over for progress and stuff like that. And also I had stories that my dad had told me about the late 1940s. And then I had this really very interesting hook for a story, historical hook, that not a lot of people know about, that the Allied forces at the end of World War II were sending out these very specialized intelligence teams to find the hidden research and development centers that the Germans had set up. And in one of these, they were the group found some very interesting prototypes for advanced jet fighters and things like that. So I used this as a hook and then jumped forward to Los Angeles a few years and set up that, this has now become a very important technology, and people are turning up dead in Hollywood. And our main character, you know, Tom, that's part of his life that's done, but all of a sudden someone he knew from the war turns up dead, and it just kind of gets you rolling into the story.
Gotcha. And now, of course, you know, we're here in L.A., and this is where we are, and it's always fun to kind of go back and see, you know, the time. I guess you're talking 70 years ago now. Wow, 70 years ago in the 40s. Wasn't that long ago.
Correct.
You're only like, it was like 40 years away, and now it's like 70 years away, so time is starting to go a little fast. So when you set a book, and of course I always like to kind of ask this question, when you set a book that goes that far back in history, how difficult is it to make sure that you get things correct? And, you know, there's no technology, you know, there's no DNA, there's none of that fun stuff that you can use. So how difficult was it for you to be able to make sure that you get those timelines and those things correct?
Well, you know, some things are just difficult. For instance, a diner that had used in the story called Tips, and there were numerous ones in Los Angeles at the time. You hit the first one in Hollywood. The one I'm dealing with was on Wilshire and La Brea, just kind of, you know, south of Wilshire. And then like four or five other locations. And I knew what my dad had told me. You know, he said, oh, yeah, you know, they were great for pancakes, you know, just off, you know, just off the alley behind the Bank of America, which if you go by that location now, there's no longer a Bank of America. It's being rebuilt as a station for the subway. But, you know, by the time I started looking for it, there was no alley. You know, the shops that had been off the alley were now ATM banks and stuff like that. So
right.
You start looking for photographs first. And I can tell you, I've seen lots of photographs of that block and nothing from the rear end. Absolutely nothing. I've got above, I've got the sides, I've got the front, but nothing. So, you know, you try and go on some descriptions, but I wasn't really feeling it. You know, I wanted some extra texture or atmosphere for the place. And I finally found it in a couple who run an Etsy store. And they had one of the original, from the period, menus. And this is not your normal menu. This is a menu made from wood in the shape of a T, double-sided. It has the listings of all the different things they were serving. And, you know, also the tagline for the place, which was thick steaks, thin pancakes. No tips. You know, you see the hamburgers for 15 cents. You see the steaks for 25 cents and all these other things.
Yep.
And, you know, it was the first thing that kind of gave me a feel for, you know, the place other than what my dad had told me. And, you know, other places, like you're probably familiar, you know, with the old Brown Derby on Las Feliz, which, you know, in the last couple of incarnations with different restaurants, now it's half a bank, you know, and half a new restaurant. You know, and originally it was some place called Willard's, the home of the far famed chicken, until like the early 40s when it became a Brown Derby. Well, I knew that place because my dad would take my mom and me there every Friday night for dinner, and at that time it was called Michael's Las Feliz. So, you know, I know what it looked like on the inside. I know that it was probably very similar, but you need to go back. You find pictures and postcards and other things. Again, just kind of wrap yourself up into it. You find descriptions. And so a lot of it was just that type of research because, again, grew up in Los Angeles. Now, historical research is a bit different. There's not a whole lot on this Army intelligence group that I was telling you about, which think Monuments Men, but just high technology and secret technology. It's kind of fanning out and trying to find it. But, you know, you track down some good sources, and then you kind of link it back to what you want your characters to do, and you know, it just, you find it. You know, it's like there's a lot of journals out there, especially for aviation, and if you can go back and find some of the older copies that may not have gotten onto the internet, you get these really wonderful details and stuff like that. You know, and some of it is you can't just search for it. There's a part towards the end of the book where there's this kind of escape, and I use a older aircraft, which was a twin-engine Lockheed 12A. And in that case, in your mind, just think of the aircraft that Amelia Earhart was lost with, and it's just a smaller version of that. So that hopefully...
Gotcha.
And so I've got the main character. He went through flight school, but he wasn't very good at it. He never has flown an aircraft this sophisticated. And, you know, it comes time to land it, and he just doesn't really know what the proper speeds are, how slow you have to get it, these sorts of things. So I had to go looking for that. And, you know, eventually I found a account of someone who had just learned how to fly it, and he's just like, you know, for most people it would be boring, but he's putting out there, okay, well, you have to get down to 110 miles per hour, or get the flaps down, it's this speed, and just like all these things, which, great, I can integrate that, into the section where, the guy isn't talking with the tower, they've got someone else, giving him the information, so, okay, this is what I got to do. It's just like saying, okay, I know I want this to feel correct, I want it to be accurate, but you also just want the feeling of, wow, this is really happening. And it just takes time to find some of this stuff.
And it's funny that you mentioned the flight, because I am right now going through pilot training, because it's something I've always wanted to do. And I said, you know what, screw it, I'm going to do it. And I get into it. So when you start talking about those things, it's like, yeah, I can kind of understand. I'm still in the infancy stage. But it is funny that getting into it, those little intricacies, you have to make sure that things can be, things have to be right and they have to be legitimate, because you don't want your reader to read something and say, wait a second. What drives me crazy is when people write books and they write sports scenes and they don't do it correct, because I'm a huge sports fan. And I go, okay, that would never happen, ever. So you can't write it that way. It's like, either if you're not sure about it, then just touch it, but don't try to get too much into it. And if, but don't write it wrong, I guess you want to say, because if you can't get that correct, then I have a big problem in trusting you through the rest of the book. So it's good that you're able to kind of get that, that kind of expertise from people to kind of understand, because it does give it that, that truth factor. And then I can trust you.
I mean, there's a huge author,
and I won't name his name. There was a huge author, and I'll just put this one. A huge author, I won't name his name, that he wrote a basketball scene at the beginning of his book. And when he finished it, I'm like, okay, that is so unrealistic how you finished that. I literally closed the book, and I said, I'm not going to read it anymore. I don't care if it was the freaking Great Expectations of thriller writers. I was like, I'm not going to read it anymore, because you can't get this right. So screw it. I'm out. I'm done. I shut the book, never picked it up again. And I guess that's just kind of what happens sometimes to me. So, yeah, research is a very, very, very important key.
I agree with you. I was, when I was in college and graduate school, I was in film school, and you get to see a lot of old films and learn about old directors. And one in particular, Erich von Stroheim, silent film director, German. His whole thing was the audience will know. He spent way too much money on all his productions, for accuracy. But, in a sense, I always agree with that, because he said, okay, if it's a certain character, if it's German and you have to have a camera, make it a Leica. It's like, don't put something else around this person's neck. Always go for the accuracy as much as you can, because the audience will appreciate it even if they don't really realize it at the time. They'll know it when they don't see it. And that always stuck.
Exactly.
And I always felt, okay. And I agree with you, especially with historical fiction. You owe it to kind of make the extra effort to make your environment seem correct. Right now I'm working on the sequel to Stateland, and a lot of it takes place in, this is also, a period, 1930s, and early 40s, and a lot of it takes place in Japanese colonial territories, and so Korea, for instance.
Yep.
And I want to know what that felt like, and so there's this other book I've just started reading to try and get myself into. It's called Under the Black Umbrella. And it's all of these personal testimonies of different Koreans of what they saw or felt, you know, just their backgrounds. And it's so worthwhile because it just sticks you in that point of reference. And you'll use some of it, you know, and all that. But it's just more of like, okay, when you write your fiction, you're going to then have this other authenticity to go along with it.
Right. So let's kind of get into, you know, Tom Jarrett,
okay.
who's kind of front in the book here. Who is he? What makes him tick? Why did you pick him? Why is he kind of faced?
Well, he's an interesting character, something of an adventurer. He's a fellow who grew up in Pittsburgh, and fell in love with the movies. There was a movie theater next door. He was a young kid. His parents, kind of gave free food to people from the theater, and so he would just watch free whenever he had free time. And what ends up happening, he just makes a decision. He's going to work in movies at some point and work in film. Then one day, you know, he's coming back from high school, and there's this raging fire. There's a whole block going up in flames, and there's a newsreel crew. And so, you know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever seen a newsreel crew, but, you know, they would drive up in these trucks, and the equipment was just, like, heavy. I mean, it's like the sound guy had boxes, you know, the film guy, they gained the cameras and everything else down. So, you know, Jared just kind of says, hey, well, let me help, you know, and, you know, he does up such a good job, he gets offered a job. And so this is all background. And so then he's off into the newsreels, and eventually in a few years he's got his own crew, and he's going all places in Europe, Africa, Near East. And, you know, he's kind of made a name for himself. And then during the war, he enlists in the Air Corps. And as I mentioned earlier, he's just not very good at it. He has a hard time landing. But what ends up happening a lot of times, while he's not good at that, it's obvious that, you know, this guy has the ability to be very intelligent, find things, very observant, so he gets stuck into intelligence and eventually gets put into this group, like I mentioned, that goes looking for German technology at the war. So, you know, flash forward, we're now in the, like, 47, 48 range, and what he's done is he's come back and says, well, I want to try something different. And so he knows different people at different studios. And he talks himself into a contract writing job. And he's very early in this. And that's when you first meet him in the beginning of the story, is that, you know, this producer is having a hard time with a script. He's looking for new talent because he hates the schmucks he's had to work with and on the writing crew. And he kind of latches on to Jarrett. And, you know, right after he gets this prime opportunity, kind of like that's when his friend calls up and turns up dead. So... In a sense, you have this guy who's an adventurer. He's had to be very smart in being able to ferret things out with the intelligence team. And now he's kind of forced into being a detective because his friend's turned up dead. He's implicated somehow in it. People are looking for him as what we have the prize in the story. And so, well, if the guy who had it's dead and he was looking for you, that means you must have it. So he's got all these different groups and factions coming to him and saying, okay, if you don't have it, help us find it, or else, you know, bad things are going to happen to you. And that kind of gets him on this kind of wrong man detective story, and he just has to flow with it and try and figure out a way to get out of it without getting himself killed or, you know, going on down for a fall because someone thinks, well, let's clear up the case and use him for the fall guy. So that gives you, you know, a bit about who he is.
Now, you have a book published, and again, I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with author George Cronus, and you can find him at georgetcronus.com, CHRONIS.com, for more information. And what people are going to notice is that you had another book published previous, Student Landlights. I'm going to mispronounce it.
It's a German word. It's Sudetenland. And that was a German word for the
and I should have known,
Bohemian
I'm freaking German, and I can't even pronounce my own ancestry language, for crying out loud.
How freaking bad is that?
I tell you. Oh, I am so fucked sometimes. I know my brain is. So, but, yeah, so give us a little bit about that, and maybe fans of that book, how are they going to notice differences now in Dead Letter File? Have you changed? How have you kind of progressed as a writer from that book to this one?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I first started Dead Letter File many years ago and put it on the shelf and then came back to it. So in a sense, there are some very strong similarities in terms of characters, pacing, using history as a backdrop. The main difference is that, so Dateland is huge, and I kind of refer to Dead Letter File as a sweet confection. There are two main characters in Dead Letter File, where there are like about a dozen in Dateland, and there's a reason for that. Dateland takes place in the run-up to the Czechoslovakian German crisis of 1938, and most people have heard of the Munich Conference. And my whole idea was, okay, what if you have a situation where before there's a Munich Conference, there is some type of provocation where Hitler just says, screw it. You know, I'm just going to do what I want to do and attack the Czechs. And, you know, it doesn't go well for them for some very good historical reasons. So three quarters of the book is historical fiction, and the last quarter is alternative history. So I have all of this material leading up to the crisis, and I was finding myself, I don't want to do just exposition, but there's things I want the people to read to see, but I need people there as characters to see it. So my solution was foreign correspondents, because they're going to be everywhere looking for the story. And I had this one character, Roz, who I just loved, and I thought, okay, let me give her some people to play with, and they were former other correspondents, and all of a sudden I had all these characters, but they're necessary for telling the story. And you get all these different perspectives of things that are happening. So it's like I said, in that sense, it's huge. But my training has always been keep things fast in terms of pacing. So it's a fast read over many pages. That might seem incongruous, but that's the case. So
gotcha.
Again, this one has much more history. You know, it took me 10 years to finally get it wrapped up because there's just so much stuff in there. And the thing of it was is that I got to know different Czechs over the years. When I was a teenager in the 70s, I had a pen pal in Czechoslovakia. And he would send me books and pictures and, you know, stuff that I had never seen before. And then one of my best friends, he's half Czech. His dad got out of Czechoslovakia after the war. And before the communists took over. And I got to sit down with him and just kind of, like, hear his stories and, you know, was able to ping him for, okay, what was it like living in this time and everything else? What do you think would have happened, you know, if there had been this change and everything else? And I kind of came away saying, you know, these guys are all talking about what if we just stood and fight instead of just giving in. We had a big army. You know, it's not like we didn't have the facilities and resources. And I said, that's a good question. Let me base a book on that. And, I'm really happy with it because I was able to do that. And in addition, it sets up this other alternate Cold War. It starts 10 years early. And but the second book is very linear. takes place in the next year. And kind of extends that. And it's going to be wildly different the further away I go, but it's just a very interesting scenario I've put myself in. I'm very excited about it.
Nice.
So is this kind of the genre and the thing that we're going to be able to expect from you, like, in the future? You're going to be doing more historical mysteries? Do you have any plans? I know that the big thing right now is to write series. Do you have any plans for any series or anything, or are you just going to be sticking with a lot more of the standalones?
Well, obviously, Dateland is going to be a series. There's probably seven installments in that. It's going to go through time. Dead Letter File, I'm not sure yet, because I have this love of 30s and 40s cinema, and these stories have a lot in common in terms of how the characters interact. So between the men and the women, there's a lot of bantering back and forth, you know, kind of a lot of vying for attention, you know, within the story. So in the case of Dead Letter File, you have Tom and Mary. You know, they're kind of like stuck together, make a good team. And so my question to myself is, okay, if I do a next book, are they still together or are they kind of like can't stand each other? So, you know, it could go Nick and Nora Charles, or it could be something completely different. So I haven't made up my mind yet. And, you know, then I have to ask myself, okay, how do I frame this? What's the next caper going to be? What's the next case going to be? And, you know, is he set up well for that, Tom Jarrett, that is? And then you have to look at other types of series where you have that type of situation. I mean, one that comes clearest to my mind is Walter Mosley, the Easy Rollins series, because, you know, Easy is not a detective. He's thrown into the situation of being one. And then you have to concoct other reasons for him to be more of one later on. So that I'm not sure yet of how you do that and be true to the characters and true to the truth of what you've already done.
Yeah, I get you. I mean, yeah, you want to make sure that, you know, you kind of have, I'm not really sure how to put this, but you got to kind of stay true to yourself, I guess, who you are as an author, and make sure that things work correctly. And, you know, once you start getting, you know, your legions of fans, you're going to have to start, you want to write what you want to write, but then you're starting to framework books in kind of the same way, I guess you want to say. So those things start happening, and then you start becoming, you know, that kind of a writer. Regardless of what your subject matter is, people start recognizing styles. It's almost like music. You can close your eyes and listen and say, oh, that's David Lee Roth. You know, you don't need to sing a Van Halen song. You just know who he is because you know his voice. And I guess that's what it is. An author has a voice, and it's when they find that voice that their books then become successful.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, yeah.
I agree.
So, well, now, we got about a minute or so left here, so what I want to be able to do is I want to give you kind of a last word to kind of let everybody know, you know, your social media, where they can find you, what you got coming up, and the whole nine yards. So I'm going to kind of leave that up to you.
Okie dokie. On social media, beyond my websites, I have a Tumblr page, which, you know, is a nice focal point. I really haven't done Facebook or Twitter just because they take an enormous amount of time to do well. And I've got other responsibilities, and it's just been hard to think, okay, well, I'm going to be here doing
yeah, you have a life, and I understand that.
So I'd rather do it well but not do it. So at this point, I'm not doing it. But, you know, that's where the places I get most of the word out. And, again, right now I'm working on the sequel to Sudetenland. I'm hopefully, if I'm lucky, I'll have that out in 1 year. Then after that is going to be kind of a very interesting sort of prequel to both that and Dead Letter File, which will be kind of fun. It'll kind of combine characters from both, not everyone, but some. And you know, that's what I'm working on right now. And I'll just leave you with, too, if you want to get a really good look at, like, old Los Angeles, there's a wonderful forum on skyscrapers. And just Google noirish L.A. or noirish Los Angeles. It'll take you right to it. And it's like it's been going for, like, years, and it's, like, lots of pages of just photographs, you know, from old Los Angeles. And it's just fun to look at. Some of the things are just kind of looking at yourself and go, we had that? That's great.
Yeah. Well, hey. I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to be able to speak with, you know, people that are, of course, on the tour, you know, doing this, because it's not easy. It's an extremely, extremely difficult thing to do, which is, you know, get yourself, you know, out there and, you know, kind of in the middle of everything. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to be able to speak with you, and can't wait to see what comes up in the future. So, keep at it, George.
Thank you so much. It's been great being on. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is George Cronus. Go to georgetcronus.com, C-H-R-O-N-I-S, for more information on Dead Letter File and everything else. We want to thank you guys so much for listening. If you tried to listen Friday night and realized that the Story Blender with Gail Lind was a little messed up, that's because it was. It will be released sometime again this week. Check out the Facebook page and Twitter. We will release when that time's going to be and make sure that we get that out correctly, because it's a great interview with Gail. We just had some technical problems with loading up the right one, and the computer was confused. I kind of confused the wrong one, so want to make sure we get that out. And we want to thank you guys all for listening. It's always been a pleasure. I'm off to Vegas for a couple days to get a little R&R. So we will see you all next time. And the magazine is out. If you have any questions, email editor at suspensemagazine.com. And until next time, everybody, we want to say thank you so much and keep on reading. Goodbye.